Okay. Well, hello, everybody. Thank you very much for choosing to attend this session. I hope it will be well worth your time. It's really good to see a lot of people here. My name is Steve Sanderson. As you can see, I work for Microsoft on the ASP.NET team. And also, as you can tell, we're going to be talking about asynchronous web applications for the next hour and a bit, showing you some of the new stuff that's possible. But more than that, digging in behind the scenes and trying to make sense of how everything actually works internally so that you can have a really good grasp of what stuff's possible and what's not and how well it's going to perform for you. So the two main benefits that we will be trying to drive towards in this talk and understanding how they work are these two, capacity and responsiveness. So your modern website probably has to deal with a lot more traffic than websites did a few years ago. And so one way you can deal with that is just buying lots of servers or paying more for your cloud hosting provision. Or you can make your code more efficient. And we'll be looking at how that can work. And then secondly, you may want to make your site more responsive than sites have been in recent years, and not just doing a kind of AJAX site where people have to make requests to your server, but finding ways of pushing information down into the browsers. And we'll be digging into various different techniques for implementing that and look at the pros and cons of all of those things. So this is the plan for the talk. This is what we're going to cover. We're going to start off by understanding how asynchronous and synchronous threading affects the performance characteristics of your web server. And not just using slides, I'm also going to be able to show you how we can measure it and actually quantify numerically what kind of differences we can aim to hope for. Then we're going to move on and have a look at some of the new language features in C# 5. I'm sure you'll have heard of await and async by now. But you may not be aware of exactly how that's actually implemented behind the scenes, so we're going to look at that. And then we'll look at some of the power that you can get with the task parallel library to do interesting things with lots of asynchronous operations. After that, we're going to change the focus a little bit and look at how we can start pushing information down to browsers, and you'll see how this all comes out of the async work that we'll have built upon there. And we'll see the various techniques, and then we'll finish off with SignalR. How many of you have heard of or used the SignalR so far? All right. Okay, that's good. That's about a third of people. So one of the ways I could have done this talk is just to show you SignalR, and it would have been amazing, and we would have all gone, oh, that's so nice, we're happy. But you wouldn't necessarily have understood how that works behind the scenes. And so the point of this talk is really to dig into all of the different pieces of infrastructure and show you how they work, so you could pretty much implement it on your own if you want. So if you're not interested in that implementation, now's a good time for you to go and find another session. Nobody will be offended. You can just slip out. But if you stay, we're going to go into the technical guts of it all and show how it all works. Okay, nobody has gone. Right. So how does this async thing work? This may be familiar to many of you, but just in case it's not, we'll whiz through it. So the way that traditionally your web server handles requests is that you've got threads in a thread pool. ASP.NET maintains a pool of a certain number of threads that can be used to handle requests. And so some requests come in, and they get assigned to threads for processing. The thread runs the code, it sends some response back to the browser, eventually the request is finished, and then those requests can go away. And the threads become available to handle some other requests. Other requests come in and they handle it, and everyone is completely happy with that, except if it just so happens that some of those requests are running long-running processes. For example, they're talking to a database or web service or something like that, and it maybe takes a long time, and by a long time I mean 50 or 100 milliseconds or something like that, which is a long time for your thread to be locked up for, because while that's happening, it can't process any other requests. So some other requests may come in, and they may finish nice and quickly, but a bad situation potentially starts to occur when all of your threads maybe end up actually blocked. And at this point, the threads are not doing anything useful. They're just waiting for your database call or your web service call to finish. They can't do anything, and you get this big queue kind of happening. And in a totally catastrophic case, your web server can just stop working. But that's not very common. What's more common is that your web server is just less responsive than it should be, and you might not even be realizing why. And I'll be able to demo that in a minute. So the other threading model, this is what I'm calling the restaurant model, because it's like when you go into a restaurant and you place your order, the waiter or waitress goes away until the food is ready. Then they bring you the food, and then they go away again. Then they eventually come back later and ask if you want coffee or give you the bill. And that's fine. What they don't do is take your order and then just stand there staring at you until the food comes and then stand there staring at you while you eat your food and then eventually, you know, ask if you want coffee. That would be mad. But that's what your web server's doing, isn't it? It's just blocked, waiting for this operation to complete. What would make more sense if it was like a waiter or waitress that went away and did something else useful while the operation was in place? So, in this programming model, maybe we've only got two threads in our thread pool. We don't need so many. And so when a request comes in, our threads go over and they get assigned to process that request. Hopefully they finish nice and quick and the thread can move on to something else. Or maybe it starts a long-running operation. And at that point, the thread wants to detach. That's the essence of this asynchronous model. The thread's back in the thread pool. And so when some other requests come in, those threads can go off and process them. So we've got some requests there that are waiting from external I/O operations to complete. They don't have any thread attending to them. At some point, the operating system will signal that they're done, and then we can proceed with them. But our threads don't need to care. They can deal with other stuff. Maybe they're doing something slow as well. Okay, then eventually those operations will complete. The operating system kernel will have some way of knowing that the I/O operation is complete, and it will signal that through into the .NET runtime, and the request will become unblocked again, and ASP.NET will attach new threads, possibly the same ones as before, possibly different ones, and they'll collect the results and do something like send a response down to the browser. So then, you know, maybe it will actually start another long-running operation. That's fine, because our thread can just detach again. And then more requests can come in and we can process them. And clearly this is a much better model. We're not blocked and we don't mind if there are a fair number of long-running operations. Okay, now, do you believe me? Is this real or is that just something on a slide? Let's see if we can actually measure it. So I've got a little demo application here. And I'll just show you what my demo application does first before we look at the code. So this is a website that returns a list of flights that are available. And it doesn't have this data locally. It has to go off to the airline's web service in order to get this flight information. So let's see how it works. I've got my cheap flights controller here. And let's make this a bit bigger. And how does it work then? So let's have a look at the model data first. I've got a class that represents the flight that we could get back from the server there. And we know that the URL of some web service that will return us this flight information. And just to clarify, let me open that URL in my browser, and you'll be able to see that what comes back from there is some JSON data relating to those flights. And that is what the application is rendering there. So I've initially implemented this in a very naive, synchronous kind of way, but it's easy to understand. So we start by creating a web client that's going to talk to that web service, and we say we want to download the string from that URL. And we're going to download it synchronously, so we're blocking our thread at that point. We're getting our data from this URL, and then we know that the data that comes back is in JSON format. We don't really want it in JSON format, though. We want these actual flight objects, so we're going to use the JavaScript serializer to deserialize the JSON to an array of flight objects. All right, fairly straightforward. And then we've got those flights, and we're going to pass them onto the view, and the view is going to render it. Easy. But how does it perform? Let's do a bit of measurements. So, little tip for you. If you download the Apache web server, you don't need to actually install it, of course, because everyone wants to use IIS. But if you nonetheless download it, look in the zip file, you'll find ab.exe. That is Apache Benchmark. And it's a really nice little command line performance sort of testing tool. So what I can do is I'll tell Benchmark to run one request, number one, with a concurrency level of 1, which doesn't make sense yet, but you'll understand in a minute. And I will run that against this URL from my browser. And when we run it, we find that it's taking about 1,000 milliseconds to come back, or about 1 second. Let's run it again, and it's taking about 1 second again, which is not surprising because that's how long the remote web service is set up to take, just to simulate that. Okay. Now, what happens if we run 10 requests concurrently against that? Well, this time, even though they're supposed to all run concurrently, they're not. Some of them are having to queue up. So in the worst case, some of them are waiting for 3.5 seconds before they can complete because they're actually backing up in this queue in the thread pool. And we wouldn't even know about it except that we're measuring it. Now, what happens if we get a nice spike in traffic because someone important tweets our website or it goes on Hacker News or something? So let's say we've got 50 concurrent requests now. It's now actually going to take a little while because there's quite a lot of queuing going on to get through the thread pool queue there. And I'm not sure if I can even be bothered to wait for that to finish. Here we go. All right, so as much as 13 seconds some of the take in there. So clearly we want to improve on this. And is that a question? Yep. Yeah, okay, good question. So why don't we just have a bigger thread pool? And the answer is, how big is it ultimately going to get? The thread pool will try to manage its own size, and it will increase. And by default, it will grow up to something like 100 or something. Or in some cases, it can be configured to be a multiple of the number of CPUs in your machine. So you might have even a couple of hundred threads. But the .NET framework itself is not really designed to work with thousands or tens of thousands of concurrent threads. It's just not really going to scale efficiently to that sort of size because there's so much time wasted switching context between these different threads. So there are fairly fundamental limits to how big you can grow that thread pool. Also, it's expensive to create the threads. They all have got like a megabyte stack that has to be reserved in the machine, and creating them and destroying them takes a little while. So basically, just having an increasingly large thread pool is not really an ultimate solution to this. What is the best solution is if we stop blocking the threads altogether. So I'm going to show you two implementations of that. The first one is horrible, and you might not understand the code, and you won't like it, I hope, because it's pretty bad. And then I'll show you a good implementation. So the first one is what you have to do right now if you're working on ASP.NET MVC 2 or 3, which support asynchronous requests, but they do it in a way that's not particularly easy to work with. So here's how it works if you're on MVC 3 right now. Let's say we'll create an async controller. We have to inherit from the async controller base class, and then instead of having just one index action, we have to split it in two. We've got an async part, which commences the operation, and a completed part, which collects all the results and sends a response back. So how are we going to issue an async request to the server? Well, here's my initial implementation of that. I'll just reformat it slightly. Not like that, like that. Okay, so what we're doing here is, again, we're taking a web client, and this time I'm calling download string async, which is not going to block the thread. The thread will not wait for that result to be available. It will just exit the method. Of course, I'm getting it from the same data. But I've also set up this event handler, download string completed, and that is going to be called by the framework when we've got the result. And we'll collect that result, and we store it in a special location. But that's not quite all we have to do, because right now the MVC framework doesn't know that we're waiting for asynchronous operations. How could it know? This is just arbitrary code. Or we might be waiting for multiple things. How does it know? So we have to tell it what we're waiting for and when we finish waiting. And we do that by using this async manager API. And we say the list of outstanding operations, let's increment that. So it goes up from 0 to 1. And then later on, after we've got our result, we'll decrement it. So it goes back down to 0. And when it hits zero again, MVC knows that you're done waiting and it's safe to call your completed action. So we want to get that data and do something with it now. We stored it in a location called JSON, so I can take it in as a parameter called JSON there. And now how am I going to send the response to the browser? Well, I can use the same code that I had before. So let me just copy that implementation, paste that in there, and now again we'll be deserializing that JSON and sending it back up to the browser. Let's try it, shall we? So in my browser, I will go to this cheap flights async method and just have to wait for the server to warm up slightly. And hopefully it works the same. It does. Run it again. Still taking about a second. Not surprising because that's how long the external web service takes. Let's measure it. So one request to cheap flights async. That's going to take, about 1 second. No surprises there then. Let's try 10 concurrent requests to cheap flights async. And now they take, about 1 second. They're not queuing. They're really running simultaneously now. There's no contention in the thread pool. Let's try 50 concurrent requests. And now it takes, still about 1 second. Slightly more, actually. The reason why it's slightly more is because I'm running this on a single core virtual machine. So it takes a little bit of time to actually queue up all the operations. But still, that's clearly a massive improvement compared with the synchronous time. And also, if you're on a multi-core server, which obviously you will be, it will parallelize even better. So that's an improvement. But what's not so good is this horrible code. Very few people actually write code like this because they're not sure how to do it. They're afraid they'll get it wrong. They probably will get it wrong. And it's more or less impossible to unit test. So people haven't really taken advantage of this. But in MVC 4, there's an improved programming model that's so nice you might even want to use it. Let's see. So I'm going to copy my synchronous implementation, and I'm going to rename it to task async. And I'm going to use the task parallel library and the new C# 5 language feature. So instead of downloading the string synchronously, I'm going to call webclient.download string task async. Okay? I'll explain what this means in a minute. And this method doesn't return a string. It returns a task of string, which is a promise that a string is going to be available soon, or maybe already available. I'll explain that in more detail in a minute. But now, because I want to actually receive the string, I'm going to use this await keyword. Say we're waiting for that task to be complete. I'll show you how the compiler deals with that shortly. And now, we can't return this action result synchronously anymore because we're waiting for a task. So we represent that to the framework by saying there's a task of action result. In other words, there's going to be an action result, but we just don't have it yet. And then, to make the compiler happy, we use the async keyword there so that it allows me to use await inside the method. Now, you see the implementation is not much more difficult than the synchronous one. But let's test how well it performs. So I'm going to go to, what was this method called? Cheap Flights Task Async Controller. So let's go to that in my browser. And hopefully that will come out doing roughly the same thing as before, and it does. And we'll now actually measure the performance there. So one request to my task async controller is going to take about a second, obviously. We'll try 10 concurrent requests now, and they're going to take about a second, like before. And I'll try 50 concurrent requests, like this, 50 concurrent requests to task async. And that is going to take, well, would you believe it, about 1 second. So it's exactly the same performance characteristics as the scary code, but now with relatively comprehensible code. But if you've not seen this task thing before, or await, or async, you may be just thinking, what is this magic? How does it work? So let's have a look at how that actually works behind the scenes. Right. I want to give you a two-minute history lesson. This is the history of asynchrony in .NET. We've had three different programming models over the years, each one slightly better than the last. In .NET 1, there was APM, and in .NET 2, there was the evented model, and in .NET 4, we introduced the task-based model. You know, hopefully, this is the one true one, but you never know. And so let's see how these work. So in .NET 1, if you want to do asynchronous file access, you would use the asynchronous program model, and you would have pairs of methods called begin and end. So you might say, begin reading a file from disk. And you would provide a callback function, or you could. That was one of the ways you could deal with it. And the callback would give you an async result. And the async result is a kind of ticket that says, yeah, I'm doing something for you, and later on when it's done, you can use this ticket to collect the results. So inside your callback method, you would call a method called end, whatever operation it is that you're doing. I hope I haven't just broken that. And then you would pass your async result ticket to it, and it would give you the result back. So begin and end. And that kind of makes sense, because you know asynchronous methods, you'd expect there to be some sort of callback. Not a surprise that that works. Okay. What's not so good about this is firstly that we've got this async result, which is this weird abstraction that people find hard to get to grips with. Like, why didn't it just pass me the result? Why do I have to go through this extra step of requesting it using a ticket? And secondly, it's quite hard to compose together multiple asynchronous operations. Let's say you want to do multiple concurrent file reads and wait till they've all done and then collect all the results together. Well, it's really not obvious how you would do that. And in fact, the way that you actually do it involves all these crazy things like semaphores and mutexes and wait handles, and just, you know, you're going to get it wrong somehow. Everybody is going to get that wrong. Eventually, you might figure it out, but it's not fun. So in .NET 2, there is a slightly better model introduced called the evented model. And in this model, there are still pairs of methods called async and completed this time. So to say we want to download some text from a web server asynchronously, we'll start with saying download string async. And we don't have any async result this time. Instead, we've just got an event handler called completed. And the thing that gets passed into that is the actual result. So you don't have to request it through some special ticket or anything. You just get the result. And that's a more natural, intuitive system. But it still doesn't help you with this composition problem. Also, for example, let's say you wanted to do error handling around this. It's really not clear where you're going to put the error handler. So, you know, this is it's a better system, but it's still not perfect. Now, in .NET 4, we've got the task-based model, and this is where it really gets nice. So this time, we have a single method whose name ends with task async. And the idea with that is it doesn't return the actual result you want, but it returns a task of that type. So in this case, a task of string. And a task of string is a promise that there is going to be some data at some point, unless there's an error. And the data might be available immediately, it might complete synchronously, or it might be available later asynchronously. We don't know. We don't have to care about that difference. And then, as a programmer, you can consume that data in three different ways according to what you're trying to achieve. So, the simplest way you can get the actual result from inside it is just evaluate the result property. And the way that behaves is it will just block your thread if it has to, because if the result's not available, it'll just block. And that gives you a very easy way of consuming the API synchronously if that's what you want it to do. But what if you want to consume it asynchronously and not block a thread? Well, you can use the continue with function. And you pass to the continue with a callback function, delegate, lambda, whatever. And that function will be invoked when the task completes. And then from inside that, you can call the result property. And you know it's safe to do that because it's already completed, so it's not going to block your thread this time. So that's nice. But still, that's quite a, you know, a big chunk of code, and dealing with lambdas and delegates and stuff, it's not looking super elegant, and it's still not obvious how we're going to, for example, start a series of these inside a loop or something like that. So C# 5 and VB11, as I'm sure you're probably aware by now, contains this keyword called await. And await allows you to just say, I want to await the result of a task and collect the result from inside it. What does that actually do then? Well, it's pretty much syntactical sugar. It's exactly the same as the thing above it. It rewrites your method, so all the statements after that point go into a callback, and it uses something similar to continue with. So it's just a convenient syntax that makes your code look synchronous, even though in fact it's asynchronous. Okay. Now, just a clarifying point. If you actually crack open the code that comes out with Reflector, you'll find it's actually a little bit more complex than that, because the actual implementation involves a kind of state machine, which allows it to do clever things involving error handling. But let's not worry about that. Conceptually, you can imagine that it's exactly the same as just putting a continue with into your code, because that really is how it behaves. Okay. So just last clarification before we do a bit more demoing. Let's just see how the method rewriting could look in a real example. So let's say we've got this method that contains an await keyword halfway in the middle of it. So the way the compiler will rewrite this is that it takes the first half. So it's splitting your method in half where it sees the await and identifying the first half of your code, which is stuff that's before it, and the second half of the code, which is stuff that's logically after it. And then it rewrites so that you've got the first half of your code running synchronously in your method, and the second half inside a continue with callback. So if you're not on C# 5, then you can just write that code like that and make full use of everything I'm about to show. But of course, if you are on C# 5, it's much nicer just to use the await keyword. Okay, is that all right? Yes, okay, good. Right, so let me give you some demos relating to this. I want to show you five different ways that we can make use of tasks now that we've got this nice way of creating and consuming them. I'm going to start by showing how we can consume things in a naive way, synchronously in series, and then we'll add increasing degrees of asynchrony to it to improve our implementation a little bit. So, jumping back over to Visual Studio, I'm going to switch on to a different solution here. And I've got a different little application now. Again, it involves fetching data from an external source. But the difference this time is that it's not fetching data from just one external source. It's fetching from these four different external sources. And what we're actually building here is a kind of news aggregator. It's going to go off to all the different news sources that our current user has expressed interest in, and it's going to fetch the data back from all of these URLs that have been configured. Sorry about that. And it's going to aggregate that into one output so we can read all that content at once. Okay, now I've got a bit of model class already set up to help me with that. So I've got this actual news source that you just saw me have some instances of, which tracks the name, URL, and what format out of these two formats it's in. And I've got a class to represent the actual output, which is the set of headlines. And finally, I've got a bit of utility code I've prepared that is capable of parsing RSS or JSON data into these headlines. But we don't have to worry about any of this. That's totally irrelevant for the course of this demo. All we have to think about is the fact that there are these news sources, and we want to fetch data from it and do something useful with that data. So let's start fetching some data, shall we? I'm going to do it initially in a very naive and incomplete way. I'm actually going to start by just fetching a single news source, so the first one out of my news sources, which just happens to be Bill Gates' Twitter feed. Okay, so I'm going to grab a reference to that first news source, and then again, I'm going to use Web Client, ask it to download the string from that URL. Again, I'm doing it synchronously and blocking my thread. I'm getting the raw data there, and then I'm using the parser utils that I just briefly showed you to extract the headlines from that, collect it up into a list of those headlines, and render it on the screen. really basic stuff. Let's just see that running, shall we? Check that it actually does work. So when that pops up on my screen, I'm going to go to this, let's see what URL it is. It's going to be home/fetch synchronously, I suppose. So home/fetch synchronously. So that's going to go off, and it's going to fetch the first news source and display it on the screen. Okay, so here we go. Some data from Bill Gates' Twitter feed there. And if I run it again, it'll do the same. Right, now let's just measure the performance here a bit, shall we? So back into Apache Benchmark. I'm just going to run one request against that. Paste that in there. And we can see that's taking just over half a second to come back from Twitter there. And that's okay. It's not really Twitter, by the way. I faked the web service. But anyway, we'll imagine it really is Twitter, and it's taking about half a second to come back. Okay, now let's say we don't want to just fetch one new source. We want to fetch all of them. So let's replace this bit of code here with a for each loop to go over all the things. And I'm going to go through them in series. So we fetch the first one, block the thread, fetch the second one, block the thread, fetch the third one, and so on. So for each data source in my collection of data sources, which I would like to have, or news sources it's called, isn't it? So for each news source in news sources, I'm going to iterate over that loop, and I'm going to fetch the string from that news source's URL, extract its headlines, and aggregate everything into this one collection. Let's run it, shall we? See if that actually works before we can proceed. And hopefully now I'm going to get not just Bill Gates' Twitter feed, but all four of those news sources. So here it comes. We've got Bill Gates, we've got BBC News, we've got some Scott Goo blog stuff, and then we've got some stuff from MS Press. And you know, we've got all the data on one screen. Let's measure how long that takes now. It's going to take a bit longer, I expect, because it's going to go to four things. Now, it's taking about 2 seconds, which is, again, because they're all faked, to take about half a second to come back. But, you know, this is fairly realistic in terms of what's going to happen when you're really processing a lot of traffic. So that's about reasonable, is what we'd expect. But what if we're running lots of concurrent requests? Now, what are you going to expect to happen if I run 10 things concurrently? You're going to expect there to be some contention in the thread pool, a little bit of queuing in order to get all the threads allocated there. So if I run it, you can see it is taking a bit longer now. It's taking about twice as long because of the contention there. So let's fix that in the obvious way. Firstly, we've just shown you how we can do things synchronously in series. Let's switch over to do things asynchronously in series. And that's not new. That's just the same as what I did before, but it'll only take a second, so it's worth seeing it again. So instead of fetch synchronously, I'm going to have fetch asynchronously. And just like before, instead of calling download string, I'm going to call download string task async, and that returns a task of string. So just like before, I'm going to say I want to await for that to be completed. And then because we don't have the action result immediately, because remember, our method has been rewritten so that it's got a callback at the end of it, it's now effectively going to be returning a task of action result that the framework needs to wait for. And then again, we need to mark the method with async so that the compiler will do that rewriting. So hopefully, that will be slightly more performant this time. One thing to notice is see that I can use the await inside a for each loop. That would be really difficult to do if it was callbacks, because you'd end up with a series of nested callbacks and repeating your code. But await just basically solves that problem for you with its clever state machine thing. So let's just see that actually works. I'll hit F5 to reload. That's just going to warm my server up. And when that comes up in a couple of seconds, then I will change the URL to fetch asynchronously, and we'll run the code that I just showed you there. So again, it's coming back with the same data, and that's more or less what we'd expect. And let's check the performance of that. So I'll run fetch asynchronously, one request, and it's going to take, what would you guess, about 2 seconds, because the web services are not getting any faster just because I'm not blocking my threads. But if I'm running lots of concurrent ones, now hopefully I won't be blocking my threads quite as much, and it's now, really running in parallel. So, it's really running all the requests in parallel. So that's an improvement. Okay. But it's still not very efficient, because it's a bit silly to be running one request, waiting for it to be finished, and then running the next one. Wouldn't it be better to just launch all of them simultaneously? So I'll show you how we can combine the task async stuff with link in order to get everything running simultaneously. And the code might seem a little bit sort of hard to digest for the first couple of seconds, but I hope you'll be able to make sense of it without too much head scratching. So here's my implementation of it. Let's just walk through it. So firstly, let's look at this method down at the bottom. It's quite easy to create your own custom APIs that return tasks, because all you have to do is create any method that's got an await in it, and then it's going to return a task of that sort of thing. So in this case, I want a nice way of, given a news source, getting the set of headlines from it asynchronously. So it's going to return a task of those headlines. And to implement that, all I do is I literally just duplicate the implementation I had before. So I'm just awaiting the output of download string task async, and then returning that result. And then, to actually consume all of these in parallel, what I'm doing in this action here is I'm using a bit of a link statement here to say, with each of these news sources, I want to map that news source to a task representing its output. And then I'll collect all these into an array. And so the type of the thing we've got there is obviously an array, because I said it was 2 array. And then the entries in the array, each of them, is a task of headline representing the output from that task. Okay, and then we want to wait for all of them to be completed. How can we wait for all of them to be completed? Well, the TaskX utility class contains this handy utility called whenAny. I actually want whenAll. So I want to wait for all of them to be completed. And the thing that that's going to return is actually not going to be a task of headline. It's going to be a headline array array. Why is it going to be that? Well, each one of these things is a headline array. And we're going to have a series of them. So it's an array of headline arrays. And then I want to concatenate all of these things into a single array and pass it onto the view. So with all of these arrays, I'm going to use the link statement select many. And if you know link a little bit, you'll know that select many takes a series of collections and combines them all into one big collection. So hopefully, that is going to aggregate all of the results in a nice kind of way. Now, if you're feeling that this code is a little bit hard to digest, I'll agree with you that it is kind of hard to guess what type that variable is going to be. But please bear in mind what this code would be like if I wasn't using the task parallel library and await. It would be a big, hairy mess of semaphores and mutexes and wait handles and things like that. And none of us really wants to see that. So this is a significant improvement over what you would have to deal with otherwise. So let's compile that and check it out. So I'm going to go to this fetch asynchronously parallel thing here. And it'll take a few moments the first time, because my web server is just coming back to life. And it actually didn't take all that long. That's not surprising, because it should be faster now. We're running everything in parallel. Let's run one request against that now. Let's see how long that takes. Oh, it's now taking about half a second. So we're not waiting for each of the results to happen. We're running them all together. They're all taking about half a second, so the combined result takes about half a second. And in fact, if we want to run 10 concurrent requests against that, let's see how long that takes. Well, it's taking slightly longer now, but not a lot longer. And what's actually happened here now is we've got 10 requests, each of which is making 4 web service calls. So we've got 40 web service calls all running concurrently and all of the results being aggregated back correctly. And it's performing, you know, an order of magnitude better than our initial implementation that was running in series and blocking threads. So that's clearly a massive improvement. Okay, now, a couple of last things before I move on to some other topics is, what if we don't really want to wait for everything to be finished, but we're happy enough just to take the first result? So maybe you're calling some kind of multiple redundant web services, and some of them might be down. You don't care about that. You just want to get the first successful result back. Well, that's quite straightforward, because we can just change when all to when any, which you have to spell right, annoyingly, picky compiler. So now I'm just going to collect the first result that comes back. And what type is that going to be? Well, if you were a normal, sensibly minded person, you would think it were going to be a headline array, because we know they all return headline arrays, so you'd think the first one is going to return a headline array. Well, we would have caught you out there, ha ha ha, because it doesn't. What it actually returns is a task of headline array. Why does it do that? Well, the point is that you might need to know which of those tasks it was that actually finished first. So we need to return to you the actual instance. Maybe you want to go and cancel all the other tasks, for instance. So now, given that instance that has completed, we can just grab the result out of it. We know that's not going to block us because it's finished now. So let's try that out, shall we? I'll run that in my browser. And hopefully we'll just get back one set of results according to whichever one happened to complete the fastest. So it looks like MS Press happened to be the fastest that time. If I run it again, oh, BBC News was the fastest, and this time, oh, Bill Gates is the fastest. So it's pretty random depending on which one happens to come back the first. And whether or not that's useful to you depends on whether you've got some situation where it really is the case that you just care about the first result. Okay, and then finally, what about custom operations? So what do I mean by a custom operation? Well, in my code so far, everything has ultimately come down to this method, download string task async. That is the underlying source of all the tasks. And I've been kind of projecting it onto different shapes, like a task of headline or a task of action result. But basically, it's all been about this download string task async at the bottom of the stack. What if you want to create some custom code that represents a task that completes in a way that's entirely custom to your application? Like maybe it completes when the user clicks a button or something funny like that. Well, you can do that relatively straightforwardly. So let's say what I want to implement is a method that looks like this, get a string eventually. And it's going to return a string, but not immediately. It's going to return a task of string. How can I create a task out of thin air? Well, you can do so using this handy class called task completion source. So if I create a task completion source, new task completion source of what type of thing I want, a string, okay, then I've got my task because I can just return to the calling method the task completion source.task property. And that gives me a fully working task that anybody can consume synchronously or asynchronously. So that's a valid implementation right now, but it's kind of stupid because the task is never going to complete because no one tells it to complete. So how do we tell that task to complete? Well, let's say in some other code, maybe after a button click or after something's happened in your database or whatever, you want it to complete. So what you would do, later, you would get your task completion source and you would call, you would call set result, some result. Okay? And at that point, the task will become completed and anyone who's consuming it will get that result. That might seem like an odd thing. Why am I bothering to show you that? Well, I'm bothering to show you that because that's going to be the basis of the next few pieces of functionality that we implement. Okay, so review. We've looked at how the different threading models give you different performance characteristics, how blocking a thread is okay in certain cases, but is risky if you're trying to deal with lots of requests because you can't let the thread pool grow indefinitely and you don't really want there to be contention. Then we looked at how the new language features make it much easier to work with tasks, and then we've just had a look at the task parallel library there and how that allows us to do things like composing multiple tasks together. Okay, that's all very nice, but where are we going to go with this? Let's try and come up with a really interesting practical application for it. Well, you'll be aware that an increasing trend on the web today is to try and make your website more responsive, more interactive, and break down the barriers between web programming and normal desktop programming. And an aspect of that is being able to send push notifications from the server to the client. So the client gets updated not just when it does a request, but at any time when the server says that there's new information it might be interested in. So how can we implement this? How can we get the server to send data to the client at arbitrary times? Well, here are four techniques you can use. Arguably, polling isn't even one of these techniques, but it's worth introducing because many of you, I bet most of you have done some kind of polling. Let's do a little poll. How many of you have done any kind of polling against your web server? Yeah, I'm not surprised. Okay, a good 40-odd percent of people there. So it's a very sort of well-known technique. And the idea is that, let's say you're writing something like a chat application. The browser wants to know, has somebody posted any new messages? So it's just going to ask the server, got any new messages yet? And the server will reply immediately, yes or no. And then the client will wait a little bit, and then it'll ask again, how about now? New messages? And then it'll just keep doing that forever. So in pseudocode, or in my favorite language, BASIC, the client makes a request to the server, and the server responds immediately. The client is then going to do something if there's a response, and either way, it's going to wait for a certain amount of time, 5 seconds, 30 seconds, whatever, and then it asks again. And to implement that in JavaScript, it's really straightforward. Let's have a function, and we call it to get started. And then inside the function, we could do an AJAX request using jQuery there to a certain URL, and we grab the result that comes back. If there is a result, then we'll do something with it. And if there isn't, then obviously there's nothing for us to do. And then a certain amount of time later, we're going to ask again. So maybe 30 seconds later, we'll do another request. And that works fine. And the main drawback to that is, of course, the fact that you've got this 30-second gap in between requests. And for a chat application, that's no good. You need to know more often than that. So maybe you'll bring down that time out to like 2 seconds or 1 second or half a second or 1 millisecond. But basically, you're going to be really running up to the limits of what you can do with HTTP if you try to do too many fast requests. So it's not a great system. An improvement on that is long polling. How many of you have implemented long polling? Ooh, a much smaller number, like about 6 people in total. Okay, so long polling is an improvement of polling which avoids this problem where you have to wait a certain amount of time before you get the result. The logic is like this. The client makes a request to the server, but this time the server doesn't reply immediately. The server just leaves the request hanging open until there's some data for it to reply with. So then it eventually replies, the client immediately does something with it, and then it opens a new request to start the whole process again. So there's always a request hanging in this system. And in JavaScript, it's very easy to implement. So again, we have a function that starts the whole process off, and it's going to do another AJAX request to the server. But this time, we know that the request won't complete until there's actually some data that is useful to do something with, like there's a new chat message. So our client is going to do something with that data, and then immediately, it starts the AJAX request again. So the AJAX request will be left hanging open again until there's new data. Now, that's okay as far as the client's concerned, but it's pretty bad news for your server traditionally, because how is the server going to leave the request hanging open? And what if there are 10,000 people connected? That's 10,000 requests left hanging open. If they're all blocking threads, that's going to be catastrophic for your web server. So clearly, you need a better system. And an obvious way of improving that would be to do things asynchronously so that you're not blocking threads. Okay, shall we have a go at implementing a little bit of that? And then I'll show you some of these improved, more modern techniques. Long polling is not that hard to implement. Let me switch on to a different solution. Now, again, this is going to be a chat example. There is a legal requirement. In any asynchronous conference session, you have to do a chat example. So I'm complying with my duties here. And I've not actually implemented it yet. I've just got this basic chat controller that renders a view. And if I go over to the view, then you'll see that my view has just got nothing but a bit of static HTML in it. So nothing really there yet. Let's bring this up in a browser just to sort of get ourselves started. And I will go to the URL for that controller, which is chat. Let's get rid of these other tabs. And when that pops up, we'll just get the string chat, because that is what is in my view. Right then, so how are we going to go about implementing this? Well, let's start by doing a request from the client to the server, shall we, to try and get a message. So I'll drop in a bit of code I've already got here, and I'm going to use jQuery to do a post request to an action that doesn't exist yet called getNextMessage. And the idea is that it's going to return the message, and then we'll use jQuery to insert that into the DOM. Right, now that's not going to work until I create this getNextMessage. So let's start by creating that, and I'll do it in a very dumb and naive way so far. I'll just have a method called getNextMessage, and it will return hello at, and then I'm going to put in a timestamp just so we can help keep track of what's going on. So date time dot now dot too long time string. Okay, let's see if that actually works, if my client can fetch that and display the message on the screen. So I'll hit reload, and then what pops up on the screen is hopefully the little message that I just put in there. Okay, that's good, that's working. Right. What are the steps to go through from here to turn this into a real chat application? Well, one of them is going to be that instead of this method returning synchronously, I want it to hang open until there is a new message that we can return. So I don't want it to return a string anymore. I want it to return a task of string because it's going to be asynchronous. And I'll even put the little async flag on it like that. So at the moment, I don't have any way of I don't have any actual messages to wait for, so I'm going to fake it up a little bit by just waiting for a certain timeout, just so that we can check this works. And one way I could wait for a certain timeout is I could do thread, then I import the namespace dot sleep. Let's say we'll wait for 2 seconds. Okay. Now that's very bad news, because that is blocking the thread for 2 seconds. We really don't want to do that. So how can I wait for a certain amount of time without blocking the thread? Well, there's a handy utility on TaskX called delay. And delay allows us to say we want to have a task that completes after 2 seconds. So this is going to return a task, and therefore we can await it. Now that doesn't involve blocking the thread, because to actually know when this task completes, it works with the Windows scheduler so that the framework will get notified after that amount of time without there being any threads waiting to watch it. All right, let's try that, shall we? Just see if it does really take 2 seconds to come back. So I'll hit reload in my browser, and the page will pop up. And there it is. And then 2 seconds later, the message comes. So again, I'll reload. And after 2 seconds, the message. All right? Okay, so now let's go and actually build this long polling loop, which is not that difficult to do. So on the client, instead of fetching stuff just once, I'm going to wrap it inside a function. So function get next message. And I'll put my braces in and indent. And I'll call the function to get things started. And now, as far as the client's concerned, this is long polling. So this request will not complete until the server's got some actual message for us. So we'll expect that to take a little while. We'll push the message up onto the screen, and then we'll start the next long poll by calling getNextMessage again. And that's all we have to do to get a basic long polling loop on the client. So let's try running that now. So the client is going to make a request to the server. 2 seconds later, the server will reply. The client starts another long poll. 2 seconds later, another message. And that's just going to continue forever. So, we've got started now. This is not a very good chat application so far. It's a little boring. You can only talk to the server, and you can only just get these tedious messages. So let's see if we can actually get some proper messages. I need a way of sending messages from the client to the server. So I'm going to do that with a little bit of an AJAX form. And I'll just drop this into my page here. I'm using an MVC begin form with AJAX. So it's going to post using AJAX to an action method that doesn't exist yet called postMessage. And it's going to send a bit of text called message. Okay, so to make this work, I'm going to have a method on my server called postMessage. So I'll implement that. It doesn't have to return anything, but it is called postMessage, and it takes in a string called message. Right, now where do I go from here? I want that message to somehow magically get from where I am here to where I am up here. How am I going to do that? And how do I know how long to wait for that thing to be available? Well, I can solve both of those problems using a task completion source. Because I can have a task that represents the availability of the next message. So let me do that. I'm going to create a static variable, so it's shared with everyone who accesses this controller, and it will be of type task completion source of string. I always type that, because that's the HTML tag. And then I'm going to call it next message, and I'll set that up, new task completion source of string. Okay. So in order to actually wait for that, I can now say, var message equals, and then await for the next message task. And then, to return that message to the client, I'll just say return message. Okay? In fact, I can simplify this code slightly further by getting rid of the message variable and just saying return await next message task. It's a very elegant little bit of code there for just waiting for the right amount of time and sending that down to the client. Okay, so how do I now get my next message to complete with this message? Well, as you know from before, I can say nextMessage.setResultMessage. And that is now actually going to work. But it's got a bit of a problem, which is that task completion sources can only complete once. So right now, I can only ever handle one message for all time, and that doesn't make for a great conversation. So let's reset nextMessage to a new task completion source. So after that's happened, I'm going to say next message is a new task completion source of string. Okay, shall we try it in my browser? Go over here and hit reload, and we'll see what coding mistake I've made today. Let's try it. Hello, submit. Okay, it worked. It went to the server, it completed the task completion source, and it came back on the client. One last thing I want to do before I demonstrate that a bit more is just point out that there's actually a very subtle bug in my code right now. You almost certainly would never even experience any problems with this, but just in case, here we are, right between these two messages, these two lines. In between these two lines, next message is in kind of an invalid state because it's completed, but we can't wait for it again now. So if it just so happens that the next client request starts waiting for next message at this point, then it's never going to complete because it's already completed. So that's not really going to work for them. So what we really need to do is not complete next message until we've replaced it with a new variable. I know that's a bit subtle, but let me just implement that now. So I'm going to swap the order of these two lines. So I'm going to say I want to refresh next message first, but so that I can still set the result on the old one, I'll capture a reference to that. So old next message equals next message, and then the thing that actually completes will be old next message. And now there's no risk that people are waiting for the wrong task. I probably could have skipped that, to be honest, because you never would have hit a problem, but just for the sake of doing things really robustly. Okay, so let me hit reload and check that it really works still. Hi. Yeah, it does. Okay, let's see if we can have two windows chatting to each other now. So I'm going to have Chrome on the left and IE on the right. And let's try this. Let's say, hello from IE. Submit, and it pops up in Chrome there. And I can say, hello, Mr. IE. How is HTML5 working for you? Submit. And there we go. That's all working nice. Okay, so that's cool. But what's not so cool about this? There are some limitations with long polling. As I said, one of the limitations is that you run the risk that you miss messages in between the long polls. Okay, how can we fix that? Well, there are a couple of new transport technologies that you could use. One of them, oh, we've just done that demo, haven't we? So one of them is called Event Source. Now, Event Source is implemented by most browsers. It's implemented by Firefox, Chrome, Safari, sadly not by one from a certain major software corporation. But anyway, it has a nice API. And the way it works is like this. So it's very much like long polling, except that it's a native feature of the browser. So again, the client makes a request to the server. And again, the server leaves the response hanging open. But the difference this time is that when there's a message to reply with, it doesn't actually close the connection. It just sends the reply, puts a pair of line breaks to signal that this is a complete message, and then the client will collect that message, do something with it, and the connection stays open. And then there's another message with a pair of line breaks, then another message with a pair of line breaks, and so on. So we don't run the risk of missing messages in between polls this time. And another nice aspect of this is that the specification says that the clients have got to do some level of error handling for you. So if that connection gets dropped for some reason, even though it's not meant to close, if it gets closed maybe by some intermediate proxy device or something like that, the client is supposed to re-establish the connection automatically. You don't have to write that code yourself. Now, the API in JavaScript is quite nice and easy. You construct one of these event source objects, you point it to a certain URL, and then you can register an event handler to say, whenever there's a message on this event source, give it to me in a callback function, and I'll do something with it. And you don't have to implement the polling loop yourself. The browser deals with that for you. Now, this is quite easy to implement. We can implement it on the server in ASP.NET really easily. Let me show you how we can do that. So I'm going to change my client-side implementation now. I'm going to get rid of this long polling code that I had before. And instead of that, I'm going to create one of these event source objects that I told you about before. And now I also want to register an event handler so that when there's a message, I'm going to do something with it. So I'm going to say when there's a message, I want to append it to that list of messages that I've got on the screen. Okay, that's not too bad. So what am I going to do on the server to actually make event source work properly? Firstly, I'm going to have to implement this get messages thing. Otherwise, it's just going to be a 404. So let's create a method there to do that. You can do this with regular MVC. So I'm going to return, let's say, I don't know what I'm going to return yet, if anything. So I'm just going to say get messages. And then I'm going to, I don't need to take any parameters. And I need to do something in here. What do I need to do? Well, here's an implementation of something that I can do. Firstly, I'm going to do it in a really naive way. So my initial implementation of that is I'm just going to set the response content type to this event stream thing, which the browser requires in order to know that the server really is working with an event stream. And then to be very naive, I'm just going to send a single message that says hello at timestamp, and I'm going to finish with this pair of line breaks so that it actually works. Okay, let's see if that works, shall we? So I'll compile that, switch over into my browser, and I'm going to hit reload. And then hopefully it will go to the server and it will fetch that event source message from the server. Oh, it's fetched another one. And if we wait, it's fetched another one. So why does it keep fetching these messages all the time when I only actually said that it should return one message and I didn't put any kind of looping construct? Why does it keep doing this? Well, this is the error handling behavior. As far as the client's concerned, the connection should not be closed. But my server is closing it. It's doing nothing to keep it open. So the client keeps thinking that there's an error and keeps trying to reestablish communication. Now, obviously, you're not meant to do this. This is a complete misuse of it. So let's fix this code now. Let's say instead of letting the response close, I'm going to actually keep the response open and send a message whenever we've got one of these next messages. So what's the next message? Well, I could again say var message equals await next message.task like we did before. And then the message that we actually want to send down to the browser, instead of hello at, I'll send that message, okay, with the line breaks at the end there. Okay. Now, I don't want to do this just once. I want to do this multiple times. And this bit is might seem a little bit alarming to you. So in order to keep waiting indefinitely, how about this? While true. Okay, so we are just going to keep doing this forever. We'll await for the next message, we'll send it down to the browser, we'll await the next message, send it to the browser, and so on. Now, of course, I need to mark my method as async so that the compiler is happy that I can use await in there. I'm still not returning anything from it. Okay, let's see if this works, even though the while true thing is a bit scary. So, back over in my browser, if I hit reload, this time, there shouldn't be any dummy messages coming from the server, but if I send something, hey there, then hopefully, oh, it didn't work. So what did I do wrong here? Let's see. I didn't do anything wrong on the client. What did I do? That's not working correctly. Let's have a look at the network tab and see if we can diagnose that. So the initial request goes up to the server. It's got a pending request there. If I send a message to the server, then it's apparently getting there but not doing anything. Okay. Does anyone know what I'm doing wrong here? I'm sorry? Oh, yes. So, such a good point. Thank you. Okay. So, just because I've written this response out to the output stream, ASP.NET may still be buffering that because it doesn't realize that we're trying to send stuff in real time. Bonus points to you there. So, what I forgot to do was to say response.flush. And that's going to make sure that the data has indeed gone down to the client. So, let's try that one more time. And then I will send my little message. No buffers, please. And I'll hit send, and it does indeed go up to the server, and it comes back down to the client. Hey. Okay, and just to check that this really is a working chat thing, I'm going to open a second tab and have that over here on the right, and I'll run that. I'll say, this is so nice. Hit submit, and indeed it does come up on the other screen. Okay, so that's great. That kind of solves this problem with missing messages in the middle. But it also introduces a couple of new problems, chief among which is the fact that this doesn't work on IE. So what are we going to do in order to create a chat system that works on all browsers? Well, we could implement multiple protocols, and that would be fine. But then one day somebody's going to say, oh, we should do WebSockets as well. And then you're going to implement a third protocol as well. And your code is going to start getting really difficult to maintain. So how about we take this from a different angle altogether? Firstly, let's just think about what WebSockets is or is going to be. WebSockets is a newer protocol still than Event Source. And the idea with WebSockets, we've done that demo. The idea with WebSockets is solving a similar problem. But the main benefit it gives you over Event Source is that the communication channel is bidirectional. Now, Event Source is unidirectional because the client does the initial request up to the server. And from that point on, everything is a response. So there's no way for the client to send more things up to the server other than by doing additional AJAX requests on the side, which is what I did in that demo. But WebSockets is different because WebSockets is a truly bidirectional protocol. The idea is that the client opens a web request to a certain URL and includes this special upgrade WebSockets header. And then the client and server do this little protocol dance where they establish which version of WebSockets they're using and agree that they really can work together. And once they've done that, the connection just stays open. And at that point, it's just a regular TCP connection. And regular TCP connections can take data asynchronously in both directions, and all of that just becomes available to you. And this connection stays open until one of the two sides decides to close it, usually the browser. And as is normal for TCP, there's a notification on the server that that connection has now been dropped, and so the server can clean up all its resources and so on. Okay, so that's how WebSockets it works, and the implementation in JavaScript is almost exactly the same as Event Source. So again, we construct a new instance of this thing. In this case, it's a WebSocket. And you point that to a URL, and it will do the connection. And then you have an onMessage handler. And when there's a message from the server, you receive that in your handler. And there's also a socket.send method so that you can send data up to the server as well. So this is really good. Why don't we all use it today? Well, the reason we don't all use it today is because this is a really complex spec, and all the browser manufacturers are having a hard time implementing it in a consistent way. So different versions of browsers support different versions of the protocol. They're not really all ready to go. This is going into IE, IE10, I believe, unless I misguessed that. So IE is pretty much, you know, keeping up with the rest of them in terms of providing this at the same time this time. But it's still not really something you can fully rely on today. The reason you can't fully rely on it today is just because there aren't enough browsers that really support it. And also, this involves the cooperation of intermediate network devices like proxies, who might freak out about the fact that you're doing like pure TCP connections through your firewalls. So while you're absolutely able to go ahead and start implementing WebSockets now, you're not going to find a large percentage of your customers are really able to use it. So how can we get the best of all of this? How can we use WebSockets if it happens to be available? And if not, how can we use Event Source if it happens to be available? And if not, how can we fall back on something else like long polling if it happens to be available on both the server and client? Well, this finally brings us to where we've been heading with this whole talk, which is SignalR. Now, SignalR is an open source library for ASP.NET and, well, it's for .NET in general, let's say. And it's created by some of my colleagues in Microsoft, and it provides nice abstractions for doing this real-time programming. And as I said, I could have just shown you this right at the beginning of the talk, but I hope that you will appreciate the benefits of having understood how all the threading models work behind it, how the task management works behind it, how the different protocol layers work behind it. And with that, you could pretty much recreate this SignalR thing on your own if you wanted. But, of course, the good news is that you don't have to because someone else has already created this robust implementation for you. And what it does is it gives you abstraction over multiple transports. So you've got one programming model to program against, and then SignalR will figure out at runtime what the browser and the server can support and, you know, connect them up with some transport that's going to work. You don't have to think about that. So when WebSockets becomes supported, your code will just start doing WebSockets without you needing to write any new code. Another thing is, on the server, you don't really have to fuss about with this task and async stuff so much because it's an evented programming model. So basically, you've just got event handlers on the server, and you don't really have to think about doing any awaits or anything like that. So even though await is quite easy to work with, it's even easier if you don't have to, right? And of course, if you're not on C# 5 yet, then it's quite advantageous that you don't even need to think about that. Also, SignalR gives us nice, robust connection management. So we don't have to have a while true statement in our code. We can trust SignalR to keep hold of the connection for the right amount of time, and then when the client goes away, to clear up the resources as well. So that's nice. And then finally, SignalR has got nice APIs for letting you do broadcasts to either to all clients or to specific ones. So basically, if you want to do this kind of real-time programming thing, why would you not use SignalR? I mean, clearly, those benefits are worthwhile, and it just saves you the hassle of implementing them yourself. So let's have a go at using it, shall we? Firstly, I'm just going to finish off this chat example by showing how we can upgrade it to use SignalR instead of all this custom code I've been writing. So I'm going to install SignalR. It comes from NuGet, so we'll say install package SignalR into my solution here. And so that will go off, and it will install all the stuff. And then, once I've got that, I don't need to write all of this junk about post message and get messages and stuff. I don't need to have that inside my controller anymore. My controller can now be just the thing that returns the UI, which is a better separation of concerns, I think you would agree. So let's simplify the controller now. I can get rid of this task completion source thing, and I can get rid of all of these other methods. Just don't need them. So all I'm doing now is just returning a view. Okay, so what is the thing that the clients are going to connect with and interact with now? Well, the main piece of API in SignalR is a thing called a hub, and that is something that clients can connect to. So I'm going to create a hub, and I'm going to call it messages. Okay, and I will inherit that from hub. So it has to be a class, of course, and I have to import the SignalR namespace. Okay, now, for a client to get the latest messages from the server, I have to allow the clients to connect to that. So should we have a go at letting clients connect to it? So over in my client-side code, I'm going to get rid of this event source stuff, and instead I'm going to put in, let's start with a couple of script libraries, shall we? Because SignalR requires these scripts. Firstly, it requires, that's the wrong bit of script, let me just drop that in there. So firstly, SignalR requires this jQuery.SignalR library, which gives us nice integration with jQuery. And secondly, we've got this magic script tag here that points to this URL that's not even a file on disk. And what that is, it's going to be a dynamically generated piece of JavaScript that acts as a proxy to the things that we've got on the server. And it's going to figure out what hubs are there and what methods exist for the clients to call on those hubs. So just so that we can see that, I'm going to have a method on my server called send, and the clients will be allowed to send messages to the server. Okay, so what are we going to do with those messages? Well, it would have been better if I'd typed this in. So when we got this message, we want to broadcast it to all of the clients. And SignalR gives us a very easy way of doing broadcasts in that it's got this thing that you just saw called clients. Okay, and clients represents all of the JavaScript clients that are connected. And let's say I want to call a function on those clients to tell them to display a message on their screen. So how can I do that? Well, what's the name of the thing on my clients? Well, we don't know, because on the client we've got JavaScript and that's dynamic code, so there's no way we can know what methods exist on the client. But if you look closely, you'll see what we've got here is a dynamic expression anyway. So I can type in any old garbage here. I can type blah, blah, whatever, and that's completely legal code. I can compile that, it's going to work fine. But I don't really want to call the thing on the client that. I want to give it a more sensible name, so I'm going to call it addMessage. Okay? So what I'm telling to SignalR here, dynamically, is that my clients have got a function called addMessage, and you can call that function and pass the message in that we've just received. And this is the full server-side code for doing chat with SignalR. Many of you may have seen this before, but hopefully this time you'll be getting a full grasp of how it works internally. So on the client, we want to actually connect to that hub now, and we need to we need some JavaScript representation of that hub. And that's what this script tag is going to generate for us. So let's see that when we run it on the client, shall we? So I'm going to reload this chat page now. Obviously, it's not going to be working just yet, but we'll have a look at the source and see what pops out. So I'll have a look at the source code here. And you'll see we've got this script tag here for SignalR/hubs. And if I bring that up and zoom in a little bit, this is all dynamically generated code that SignalR is producing for us. And we're not really meant to read this, but if you do read it and you look inside it, you might discover that about two-thirds of the way down, there's this thing here. Now, this is dynamically generated messages. That is not there by default. That's only there because on the server, we've got a hub called messages. So that's been dynamically inserted. And then you see that that's got a function on it called send that takes a message and a callback. Well, the send and the message bit of that has been dynamically generated because that's what methods I've got on the server there. And you'll see it even changes the case of the method name to lowercase, Pascal, camel case, to match JavaScript conventions. But that's just for convenience. So my client-side code can now grab a reference to this hub and start doing things with it. So let's have a go at doing that, shall we? Firstly, we need to tell the client to actually connect to the server. So here's a way that we can do that. We can say, firstly, I want to get a reference to the hub, okay? So I'm going to have my messages hub, and that's going to come from the jQuery integration. SignalR registers itself as something called connection, $.connection, and then the name of the hub is messages. Messages, if I could type properly. Let me just check that. So yes, it is called messages. Okay. Now we also need to tell the client to really open that connection and negotiate what transport protocol it's going to use. And the way we do that is we say $.connection.hub, that means all the hubs, .connect, is it? Or start is, yes, start. Okay, so the client will actually make a connection to the server now. All right. Now, we need the client to be able to receive messages from the server. And we know that the server is going to be looking for a method on the client called addMessage. So let's create one of those methods. So here we go. My messages hub now has got an addMessage function, which is going to take this parameter message from server, and it's going to display it on the screen just like before. And then the last thing we need to do is we need a way of sending messages to the server. So we need our clients to be able to actually invoke this method. And I'm not using the AJAX aspect of this form anymore. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use a bit more jQuery to actually intercept the form submits. And I'm going to pick out the message that the user typed in. And I'm going to send it to the message hub. That's the critical line of code there. And then just for convenience, I'm going to blank the text box out like you'd expect to see in a chat app. And then I'm going to make sure that it doesn't really submit that form anymore. So let's try this. Unless I've forgotten something this time, hopefully, we'll reload that. And hopefully, the client will have negotiated the connection with the server. And I type something in and hit enter. And it does indeed go up to the server. And it goes through SignalR there. And it's coming back down onto the browser. And if we looked at the actual wire protocol, we'd see that because I'm in Chrome and my server doesn't support WebSockets, that would be using event source. And just to prove this works on IE as well, and that it'll correctly negotiate this between the two, so I'll type something into here. That's so much better. better now. I can type that in, and indeed it's going to pop up on Chrome as well. So I've now got pretty much the best of all worlds, the best protocol that I can have on Chrome, and the best protocol that I can have on IE, and I didn't have to fuss about that or implement the connection management. So that's really cool. That was us looking at SignalR. All right, I know what many of you may be thinking. You may be thinking, all right, that's very nice, but to be completely honest, I don't really write chat applications, and that's not really a very common business scenario. So let's just finish this whole thing off by spinning it round to a more realistic business case, which is making real-time price updates on the client. So let me change my solution for one last time. I'm going to go over to something that will look a little bit familiar. So file... recent solutions, and I will get my SignalR prices starting point here. So when this comes up, you will recognize it. So remember the cheap flights controller from the beginning of the talk? Let's just run that again to recap what that actually does. So when that pops up, hopefully it's going to display that list of prices that we saw before. Slightly different implementation now, but that's inconsequential for this particular demo. So again, we're returning these flights. The thing that's actually mainly different now is that I've also implemented an administrative interface. So an administrator could go to the URL, what's it called, price admin, okay? And when they go to that URL, they get this nice grid of all the flights that we've got and the prices for those flights. So maybe our administrator goes, oh, that New York flight, that's a bit too cheap because we're down to the last ticket that's available. So let's change that price. I'll bump it up to £1,000, dollars, euros, whatever. Okay, and then I'll save that. And then as far as my administrator is concerned, they can see that, come back, that the New York flight is there increased to £1,000. But the people on my website can't see that. They still think it's 755. And so they're going to get a nasty shock when they try to book it. They won't know that it's changed until, of course, they hit reload in their browser. That's a bit unfair, isn't it? Expecting them to know that they're supposed to hit reload. So how can we solve this problem using SignalR? Well, let's get started by, of course, installing SignalR into the solution. Okay? And I'm going to create a nice little hub that's going to manage changes to prices. So let's get started by creating my my price updates hub. So public class price updates hub. And again, I'll implement inherit from hub there. Okay. Now, public methods on here are things that the client can call. So that's for clients sending things to the server. On this occasion, I don't need the clients to send anything to the server because I'm only using it to push things down from the server to the clients. So I don't need anything in there right now. Let's just start by making our clients actually connect to that hub, shall we? So this is the view that rendered that list of flights. You can see it does a for each over all the data and prints out all the flight information. Not very amazing. Let's start by getting a connection to the hub on the server here. So again, I'm referencing this jQuery SignalR library, and I'm using the magic SignalR hubs endpoint to generate the JavaScript corresponding to price updates hub. And then I'm taking a connection to it, and I'm making sure that that all gets started. Okay, so what I want to do now is on the server, I want to send messages to everyone who's connected to that hub. And when do I want to send those messages? Well, I want to send them at the point when the prices change. So I'm going to go into the price admin controller. This is what the administrators make edits to. And specifically, when they make an edit, they call this post action called edit, which takes in all the data that they've changed, and it saves it to the database. And what I want to do now, as well as save it to the database, I want to notify all clients in real time. Okay? So what I want to do is call a method on... I want to call something for everyone who's connected to Price Updates Hub. Okay? So what would be nice is would be if there was some static method on that called something like do price update or something like that. And I would like that method to take a flight ID, a price, and a price updates message. Now, of course, there isn't any such method yet, but I can do control dot and do the generate method stub thing, and then press F12 to jump into that, and I've got my little method here. And so what I want to do now is send a message to all of the clients. And what you might hope is that I can type clients dot and then send the message, but I can't. Why can't I do that? Because this is a static method. So you can only access clients directly when you're on an instance method, because when you're on an instance method, that is when SignalR is managing the connection. Because this is not a request that's managed by SignalR, I can't get access to the clients just yet. But there is a way of doing it. It's a little bit clunky, to be completely honest with you, and I'm hoping that this API will be improved. But as it is right now, what I had to do to figure this out is go on the site document, the SignalR documentation, basically. And the documentation explains that if you want to get a reference to all the clients for a hub when you're outside that hub, you can do so by grabbing an instance of this connection manager thing through a dependency resolver, and then you can call get clients and say which hub type you want the clients for. So I fully admit that that is not obvious code, but it is covered on the documentation, and hopefully there'll be a nicer API for that soon. Anyway, now I've got the all clients, I can call my dynamic methods on that. So I'm going to call a method that I'm just inventing called something like notify price change or something like that, and I'm going to pass down to the client the flight ID, the price, and I'll format that to currency just so the client doesn't have to, and I'm going to pass down this update message that the administrators can enter as well. Okay, so let's try that. Finally, on the client, I need to actually implement this notify price change. And here is my implementation of that. So what I want to do is receive those three pieces of information. Did I spell that right? Yeah. Okay, the three pieces of information, and I'm going to use jQuery to grab that row, animate the background color, change the price, and just generally display stuff on the screen. So let's run this to finish the whole thing off. If it works, that is. And then my site is going to reload, hopefully. And then let's say my administrator over in IE, let's say they're going to offer a bargain price on the Paris to Tokyo flight right now of a mere £5. Let's just change that. And I'll put bargain, yeah. And then as soon as I hit the save button, you see that pops up immediately in my other browser there with a little notification, and my client, you know, the end user will hopefully snap that up and get themselves off to Tokyo. And of course, that's going to work not if I've just got one client, but even if I've got tens of thousands of clients connected, according to whatever your server can handle, they'll all get that message. So hopefully you appreciate that that's a realistic business case for when you might actually want to do this. Quick summary to end the thing off. We went through looking at various aspects of how you can improve the capacity of a server by doing asynchronous thread processing and doing TPL stuff. We then looked at various ways of doing push notifications to the client, and we saw our SignalR gives us a nice programming model for that. So I'll finish off by leaving this slide up on the screen of three things you can do if you want to learn more. The MVC 4 beta was released yesterday, yay for that. So you can now go and download that, and you can download previews if you want the async await thing. Thank you very much. I'll be around for a few minutes if you want to ask any questions.